Hello and welcome to 251, two arrangers, five podcasts, one subject. And the subject of these podcasts is Marty Paich. Today we'll be talking about Marty Paich and his work with Mel Torme, the singer. My name's Simon Whiteside.
And I am Giles Thornton.
Giles, you tell me a bit about yourself.
So, hi there, I'm Giles Thornton. I'm a arranger, composer and copyist based in and around London. I've got two albums to my name, one being Be In Today, which was my debut big band album in 2018. And then I wrote another album called All At Sea that we kind of got into the studio and collaborated together with a septet. That was called All At Sea, and that was recorded in 2020. I'm now working on my third album, which is going to be an orchestral album. So yeah, that's a bit about me.
Excellent. Well, we're here to talk about Mel Torme and Marty Paich and their collaboration, and we'll do that in one moment after this little break. So we're going to talk about the album Marty Paich Swings Schubert Alley. That was the pinnacle, I think, of personally, of their collaboration.
Yes, absolutely.
And so what are your thoughts generally on that album?
Well, I just think it's absolutely brilliant album in terms of, you know, it's just a masterclass on how to write for standards and how to write for singers. In general, you know, you've got some of the best known kind of big singer standards out there. You know, Too Close for Comfort, On the Street Where You Live, you know, Too Darn Hot, Old Devil Moon. There's a few oddballs in there as well, like Lonely Town, which is from On the Town, which is a bit of an obscure Bernstein musical, but a beautiful standard.
Made into a film, of course.
Absolutely,
as well with that there's a series of those films which are really good. They've got really good music on them.
Yeah. I recently did a arrangement of an On the Town medley, and it was like, how to rewrite Bernstein. You can't rewrite Bernstein.
No.
You know, it's it's absolutely beautiful album. And one thing I would say is, you know, in terms of the lineup, it's very, very similar to The Birth of the Cool, in terms of the Miles Davis album, Gil Evans, which was released in 1957. And obviously Mel Torme Swings Schubert Alley was released in 1960.
The singles were out from 49, of course, which I think is... And they based... the Mulligan's Tentet was very similar, not surprisingly, because he was one of the arrangers, wasn't he, on Birth of the Cool. But you're right, the actual album edition of Birth of the Cool came out in 57.
Yeah.
But that was after the Bethlehem recordings of the Fred Astaire album and the with Marty Paich Dectet. So it's an interesting... I think that it's... That particular album, Birth of the Cool, has a lot of influence on the West Coast people, I think, in general. And the East Coast, because the Monk at the Town Horn has French horn on it. And, you know, it was a Claude Thornhill bringing in French horn and using tuba had a huge effect, I think, on the sort of hip arrangers of that time.
Yeah, and, you know, one thing to say about, you know, the contrast between The Birth of the Cool and Mel Torme Swings Schubert Alley is that, yeah, it's a similar lineup, but it feels totally different. And, you know, this album, Swings Schubert Alley, it feels, in terms of the arrangements, quite understated. you know, there's some big moments, but it's all quite restrained in terms of the era, and it just sounds really quite hip.
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, Claude Thornhill Band did go for that non-vibrato sound. So they came out of the 40s where vibrato was big on the reed sections particularly. But yeah. Also, you know, Harry Sweets Edison and that sort of wide or even lip vibrato type thing. And I think that you're right. There's a, I think one of the reasons those albums sound so good today and, or more correctly, sound like they could have been recorded last week is that they are that modern, what has turned out to be the modern way. So you wouldn't hear a Maria Schneider chart with excessive vibrato on it, would you really?
No, absolutely not, no.
And, you know, all of those sorts of people from post-Gil Evans era, really, I suppose, you wouldn't hear too much vibrato on stuff unless they were doing a tribute to a 30s big band or something like that, where it was a much more common thing. So is there anything in particular that you think about the instrumentation?
I find it really quite interesting in the fact that in Meltor May, in this album, there isn't much piano, if at all. It's not really in the personnel. And it makes it, like, if you listen to it sonically, it could be a brass album.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because, you know, the alto sax, the tenor sax, French horn and barium, almost like a horn, French horn section.
Yeah.
In terms of the way they're treated, you know, within the section. And also the kind of use of the tuba as a kind of standalone instrument from the bass is really quite inspiring in terms of the way Marty Paich uses it.
They certainly discussed the Birth of the Cool as a model and the Mulligan Tentet as a model. And, of course, in the Mulligan Tentet, there is piano, but it's only when Jerry Mulligan isn't playing the baritone.
Yeah.
So he plays piano on those albums, but as a... And in fact, he had another baritone player in his band, which allowed him to play more piano, perhaps, than he might do. And I think that he's also his Chet Baker pianoless quartet, I think Mel Torme was fond of. And of course, Mel Torme, we must remember that this is very much a collaboration, even in terms of the arrangements and the... We don't know exactly how much of these arrangements comes from Mel Torme and how much comes from Marty Paich's head. I think they were very much simpatico in terms of the approaches. And I know for a fact there that Mel Torme wrote a lot, obviously, the scatty stuff, but he also had quite strong ideas on how the tunes should be sung.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they sort of thrashed out between them the way of realising that with the backing.
Absolutely. You know, like for instance, Too Darn Hot, the kind of rhythmic aspect of that, I can imagine that comes straight from Mel Torme being a drummer, being a very, very rhythmic singer in general. All the kind of pushes and all the kind of, you know, the rhythmic side. I would believe that was a definite collaboration between the two.
It's an interesting point you make there about the drumming, because I think what makes Mel Torme special in this period, and in fact across his life, he's not a singer with a band. He's very much another musician in the band. No disrespect to singers in general, but he is much more of a musician in the terms of his overall input to the project, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
rather being just being a fantastic interpreter of lyrics and having a lovely voice, which some, you know, Ella Fitzgerald was unbelievable.
Yeah,
but didn't write that much music. She did write some, but not an enormous amount. Whereas with Mal Torme, he'd done the whole Maltones thing with his vocal arrangements, and he appeared as a drummer in his own right, you know, as it were, in a band. And he'd also been on film, I think, bizarrely in a Frank Sinatra film. I think
right.
he played a drummer in a band. But yeah, so I think you're right. I think his rhythmic sense and his sense of pitch is unbelievably good. I mean, there's in the pre-auto-tune world, it's so perfect, his tuning.
Yeah, it's honestly astounding, you know, and it really, I think it really shines through in the way that Marty Paich and him work together, you know.
Yeah, I mean, if anyone I know who's less than a big fan of Mal Torme, it's usually that problem of it being too good, if you like, being so polished that some of the character is lost. But personally, that's not something that bothers me, but that is a criticism I've heard by other people.
Mm.
And it's interesting because there's a really, if you haven't heard it, there's a brilliant album that I don't think it's been available for that long, but that he made two live recordings from the Crescendo, which was a club in LA. And he, one of them's with Al Pellegrini, who was the musical director on his first Bethlehem album called, what is it called? It's a Blue World. There we are.
Yeah.
Memory failure there. but Marty Paich did four charts on that particular album. But there's the second recording is with Marty Paich on piano. In fact, it's called the Marty Paich Quintet. And it's an interesting quintet. It's Don Fagerquist or Fagerquist on trumpet. He's got Mel Lewis on drums. I'm not sure who's on bass, actually, but could be someone like Joey Mondragon. But he's also got Larry Bunker, who plays hand percussion and I think sometimes vibes, which is a really interesting combination. Those albums really show Mal Torme live as an entertainer. He does a lot of jokes and does a lot of, you know, patter. And of course, that's not a studio thing, if that makes sense.
No.
But he was a fantastic entertainer. And on those, in the wild, for want of a better word, he has a lot more character, if you like. And in the live situation, he's not in that sort of studio frame of mind where, but both him and Marty Paich were real martinets in the studio. They absolutely wanted it to be right, and that's why all the top musicians wanted to be on those sessions like Art Pepper Plus 11, because they knew there'd be great arrangements and also they'd be pushed to perform them absolutely the best they could.
Absolutely, yeah, totally agree. You know, there's a stunning version of A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square with Mel Torme and I think it's George Shearing or George Shearer on piano. It's at the end of a gig and it's I'll Be Seeing You.
Mm.
And it's just the way it's set and the, you know, all the musicians of the big band are there.
Mm.
And they're all in awe of this just moment of just class.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the pitching is perfect, the phrasing is absolutely dead on, and there's a note right at the end, when I'll be seeing you, which is, he holds just forever.
Yeah,
this one note, and it's in a really weird area of the voice as well, where it's just right on the break.
Yeah, yeah.
It just nails it, and just you can see everyone is kind of like in ecstasy.
Yeah.
Let's say.
So, well, is this a filmed thing that you've?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't remember.
I mean, he did some stuff with the Shearing in the 80s. It's probably, is it that?
Yes,
later in his life.
Yeah. Late. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even then, it's just stunning, utterly stunning.
Well, let's bring it back to what we're talking about today.
Yeah.
So we've done a bit of a general thing talking about the album Schubert Alley, and of course the name Schubert Alley. Schubert Alley is a place in New York between a couple of theatres, on Broadway, and it's basically the swing Schubert Alley idea is that these are all show tunes, aren't they? Essentially,
yeah.
So there's a few things I've written down in my notes about some arranging techniques which I think come from the whole album before we go into any detail. And generally speaking, they are not from the songs we're going to talk about in detail. The first thing I've got written down here is Marty Paich's arranging techniques we're talking about. My first one is what I call the rule of three. And an example there is the beginning of Too Close for Comfort.
Yeah.
Where he plays that backing figure, and dat, dat, second time, and dat, dat, and then third time, dat, 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 da, da. So he just makes the third one different. And he does that quite a bit, I find. I don't know if you'd agree on that one.
Absolutely, yeah.
And then a second thing that I find that he does quite a lot, and he does it much more in this album than he has done on others, is he builds tension by an extension of the form, normally where you get to a phrase end and he'll hang on. So in Too Close for Comfort, that in the introduction, and it goes on for longer than you'd expect. So
yeah.
It makes the phrase 12 bars rather than 8 bars, or sometimes even odd numbers of bars. And he does that in Sleeping Bee as well, for example.
Yeah.
And another one I've got here is using quotes from other tunes to comment. And by that I mean, so in Once in Love with Amy, in the second A section, he has other songs which people may well know the lyrics of, like Making Whoopee is one of them. So that it's commenting on the song you're recording by bringing in potential lyrical or lyric, in terms of the words, references that you're sort of thinking, oh yeah, Making Whoopee is about marriage, and once you're in love with Amy, you're hooked, and all that sort of stuff. I'm not sure if there are any other examples. There's two tunes that they do in that particular A section which both comment.
Yeah.
And of course that tune also has the tuba as bass part, which we could discuss in a moment. So it starts with just tuba and voice, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And that is very non-standard in terms of, you know, you'd expect, you know, sometimes in that era to have, you know, double bass and voice, and maybe drums do a bit, but just having tuba and voice is not unheard of, but it's a bit more obscure. Definitely.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting one because there a lot of the tuba players became double bass players because, you know, as banjo players became guitarists and the like. Strangely, a lot of violinists became sax players.
Now, I didn't hear of that.
Yeah, particularly the theatre people who, a lot of alto sax players learnt the violin.
Oh, wow.
For doubling purposes at that. Violin players, sorry, learnt the alto sax for just to keep working, really. Because if you think about it, violins were Paul Whiteman, those sorts of bands.
Ah, yes.
Were often led by a violinist. And
mm.
Anyway, so the tuba players became bass players, and there are people who play both, like Red Callender played both.
Yeah.
And I think, in a way, at the time, it may not have seemed quite so original as it does today, in a strange way, because the tuba had been the bass instrument in many other bands, particularly before amplification, because it's much louder than the double bass. So,
yeah.
And as was the bass sax used in that sort of way.
Yeah, like, you know, in back Dixieland, Louis Armstrong, Hot 5, you know, there's sousaphone, tuba were commonplace. You know, I totally agree.
Yeah, but no amplification in those days, so it was just, it was kind of sonically necessary.
Yeah.
And that's the same with the guitar, isn't it? Replacing the much louder banjo. and much harsher sounding instrument with a much more mellow sounding and more sophisticated capabilities with six strings for chord voicings than the four string banjo, for example. So another thing I've got written down here is clever modulation gambits, which I think is a particular hallmark of, of Marty Paich.
Absolutely, he does that a lot during, you know, not just thinking about this album, but also like Fascinating Rhythm as well.
Yeah.
You know, the descending two fives, Fascinating Rhythm, Fascinating Rhythm, you know, when it goes down. And he does that a lot on this particular album as well. But I'm sure we'll talk about that.
Yeah, we can talk about that in terms of the charts we're going to talk about in detail. I mean, one of the things he does, one of my favourite ones. See, I think a note to arrangers out there who you know, if you're bothering to listen to us, one of the things that is really clever, I think, with Marty Paich is he will quote something that you know, then modulate that into the new key. So you go with him, and then the new key is established. And one of those things is that he quotes that Monk blues, doesn't he, to kick off the solo in Too Close for Comfort.
Yeah.
And we're in the new key.
Yeah.
But another one that he does in On the Street, he'll go... And then you're in the new key. So using I'm Beginning to See the Light as a quote, but also as a vehicle for, you know what this is, and now you know what it is in the next key, so we can go off into the next key and you're all prepared. It's not sudden, I suppose.
Absolutely.
So another thing I've got listed here, so sorry I'm sort of rushing through these a bit here, but you're going to talk about this, I'm sure, in when we come to the arrangement that you're going to focus on, but the use of the French horn as a solo accompaniment to the singer.
Yeah.
Particularly good example of that is the opening of Old Devil Moon, which is just Mal Torme and French horn.
Yeah.
And I think Marty Paich used, he really made it in these albums, he made a big deal of the French horn and the tuba. He'd used French horn before quite a bit, but he doesn't himself choose to use tuba in his own arrangements much after this. He tends to stick with the bass trombone because I think it has more, well, it can be muted, for example, which gives an arranger more colour, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Now, one thing I've got here, I mean, it's under Marty Paich, but I suspect this is a bit more of a Mal Torme influence, although Marty Paich does it in a lot of his arrangements that don't have singers in, is this use of a blues scale to add tension, particularly, or in fact, to enhip, is that a word? I've just made it up. To bring hipness to a line. And a really good example of that is in Young Lovers, where at the end of the phrase each time, Mal Torme will sing something that is not in the melody, but a blues, basically a blues scale. And that also sort of delineates him from Frank Sinatra, who's in many respects his economic big rival. Because he's, you know, a lot of these songs that he recorded on Tuba Alley, Sinatra had fairly recently recorded as well. So it's sort of saying, I'm jazzier than you, mate, in some respects. And he also does that on All I Need Is the Girl.
Yeah.
Another thing I've spotted in Mal Torme's use, perhaps Mal Torme, perhaps Marty Paich, this possibly comes more from Mal Torme because it's to do with the structure of the song. He'll sometimes use the verse, he'll often use the verse where it normally is, which is before what we call the song, the chorus. But sometimes he'll use the verse in the middle of a chart as a way of sort of being almost like a middle eight type thing in a modern pop song. Particularly if it's something that can be sung in time as opposed to the sort of rubato, colla voce type things.
Mm.
And something you brought up a moment ago, so this is another Marty Paich thing, and he does this a lot in his big band writing, is what is sometimes called in New Orleans jazz the Big Four. So I can't remember which song you were illustrating it on, but where you go one, two, three, ba, dum, ba, dee, dum,
oh, Fascinating Rhythm.
Yeah. So he does that quite a lot. And I think that is a very... It's not a syncopation, really, but it sort of brings the bar line a beat forward, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And I think it also gives massive emphasis and takes you away from the four on the... You know, the bass playing in four.
Yeah.
So the bass player goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
There's a bit of waiting. I mean, the drummer normally plays through to a certain extent.
Yeah. If I remember correctly, isn't it in Too Darn Hot?
Yeah, there's a lot of it in Too Darn Hot.
Yeah,
And there's also a lot of... Well, it happens a great deal. I mean, I think it happens in... Yeah, I mean, there's probably five or six examples in that album, and plenty in others. Rather than scrabble around, stick with my notes, because then I won't make... I'll make less of a fool of myself.
It's fine. I've already made a fool of myself, so it's fine.
Now, the other one that I like is the way they develop text. So sometimes, and I'm sure that's a Mel Tormeism, because of course he was a very successful songwriter. In fact, I read a great line about something like, one of the liner notes, it says, in the writing of the Christmas song, he's in the Tune Monkeys Club or something like that. Right. You know, a full life member of the Tune Writers Association or whatever. I'm sure that's one of his... Well, it's probably his most well-known song, isn't it?
Yeah.
But he did write quite a few songs in this sort of Tin Pan Alley sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they do develop the text quite a bit, and Too Close for Comfort is an example of that, where he just alters the original lyrics to be a bit more... It's almost like a vocalese, but not quite a vocalese. It's just for a phrase here and there. And the other thing that happens quite a bit is not finishing a vocal phrase to create tension and maybe to repeat it.
Yeah.
So, if it is I'm in love, he might just sing I'm in. I'm making that one up, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And then finally deliver the end of the line at the end of the song or at the end of the section, whatever.
Yeah.
And another thing, of course, being a percussionist, they use the band sometimes as percussionists, don't they?
Yes.
And that's actually a trick that John Williams nicked for... Johnny Williams being a very good Andre Previn, Johnny Williams, Johnny Mandel, all those guys knew each other very well and worked for each other and arranged sometimes, you know, for each other under pseudonyms and, well, you know, helped each other out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Deadlines before Sibelius, deadlines were even tougher. And other software is available, like Dorico, for example. The new hip thing.
Yeah, don't do finale.
That's for the Americans. But yes, that idea of finger clicks, and there's a bit where Mal Torme in Once in Love with Amy, where he does a couple of hand claps. Once in Love, da 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 da, that sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, to finish my thought, John Williams used that in Catch Me If You Can. That sort of da. That idea of the band clicking.
Mm.
And multiple times with Mal Torme's incredible control, he often sings just with bass and drums, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And is never deviating from the key, unless he modulates, of course.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, the absolute epitome of that on this album is the Just In Time, where the band barely comes in. It's only in the last sort of third to quarter of the song where the band comes in with like a shout chorusy thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
So as an arranger, we always want to have colour, don't we? And he uses mutes well, different types of mutes.
Yeah.
In Sleeping Bee, there's quite a bit of cup muted and harmon muted trumpet obbligatos.
Yeah.
Which brings me on to that idea of improvised backing. So sometimes, it could be written, but it sounds to me that on occasions, he'll start them off on a phrase. So, for example, that Making Whoopee thing, where the, can't remember who the tenor player is on that, but might be Bill Perkins or someone like that, but it's sort of da di da di da do do di ba da ba 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 li ba li 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 li. It sort of wanders off in the mist of improvisation, and that's a common technique, obviously, where you just have one instrument obbligato soloing ish behind, filling the gaps and all that sort of thing.
Absolutely, yeah.
The one thing Marty Paich seems to do a lot is quote from other fairly contemporary tunes, as opposed to choosing. I mean, so Dexter Gordon will quote from the American Songbook a lot.
Mm.
And those songs were written in the 20s or 30s. But one of the things that Marty Paich seems to do is to quote tunes from, you know, the bebop era, which is only 10 years ago when he was writing these things.
Or
15 years at most. And, you know, obviously all of those tunes on the Art Pepper Plus 11 are that sort of tribute to those Dizzy Gillespie type period songwriters and heads. And that turns up quite a bit, doesn't it? I mean, for example, at the end of Sleeping Bee, at the end of Just in Love with Amy, Once in Love with Amy, even, get the song right, he quotes, which, in fact, Mal Torme sings, well, Amy's in love with me, boy, and then the band quotes that back at him.
Yeah, a great hook, that one. It's brilliant.
That's was that Things Ain't What They Used To Be?
Yes.
That blues? Yeah.
Yeah, it's brilliant blues.
So a couple more things before we unleash you on situation. obviously, Mal Torme's famous Lulu's Back in Town with that pedal, the tuba pedal and tuba baritone bass pedal. But that's used quite a bit. So in Hello Young Lovers, in Old Devil Moon, sometimes it's a phrase, bum dum 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 dum, that sort of pedal, but or might call it an ostinato. But sometimes it's just ba ba ba, you know, just often on the 2 and 4 rather than anywhere else. So I've mentioned use of ostinato, and the other thing, I think you mentioned this already, was that idea of having the answering or filling in the gap for the singer. So Mal Torme will say something, sing something, and then the band will fill, sort of stab in the gap.
Absolutely,
gaps.
Yeah.
So that's sort of, it's almost like, it's not exactly call and response, but it's Mr. Pants for romance is not
boobadoodle-doodle-doodle-doodle-doodle.
Yeah. That sort of thing.
Yeah.
And of course, the other thing that Marty Paich does a lot in many of his different arrangements is these phrases, which are they're like little ostinato phrases that go to a top note, and then he'll go ba do da ba do da ba do da ba do da.
Yeah, that's Too Close for Comfort.
He does that in Two Toes.
Yeah.
But each of those top notes has got a different harmonisation under it, so it's like, it's almost like one note samba type approach. So he's really, he's not a massive reharmonizer, is he?
No.
He does tritone substitutions quite a bit, and like you say, those sort of 2-5 dee da dee da dee da dee da doo da doo, those sort of cycles he does quite a bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
In Once in Love with Amy, he does that almost like the sort of so what kind of voicing. At one point, which is quite different.
Yeah.
But I mean, I mentioned in my introduction that we talked about the Christmas song in one of our 251 Christmas special shows. But there's a version on my playlist of that, which is Jacob Collier's version of the Christmas song. And now there's a guy who reharmonizes his reharmonizations on top of his reharmonization.
Yeah. He eats reharmonization for breakfast.
He does, and then and sings it later. So, is there anything you'd like to add to the sort of general arranging tropes of Marty Paich?
I think you've covered it more or less pretty well there. You know, it's I think you've covered more or less all of it.
So hopefully you haven't stolen your thunder there.
Oh no, not at all, not at all. I've got a few things.
You have some thunder up your sleeves.
I do.
That's a good name for an album, Thunder Up My Sleeves.
Yeah, I'll consider it for my third album.
So we've got... So we're now going to talk about two charts in a bit more detail. So we'll start out with the one that you've chosen to focus on, which is Surrey with a Fringe on Top.
Yes.
So would you like to give us a rough... by the way, there'll be a link on the webpage to my Apple Music playlists if you want to listen to all these things. Pretty much everything's available on all the streaming platforms these days, but there are sometimes the odd gap that I found that Spotify has something and Apple Music doesn't, or the other way around. But generally speaking, you should be able to find them without having to get yet another subscription. But
yeah.
So we're going to talk about Surrey with a Fringe on Top, and let's have a short break, and then I'll hand over to you, and you can bring it in.
Fantastic. So I'm going to be talking about the second track of side B of Melt All My Swing's Shubert Ali, which is Surrey with a Fringe on Top, which was originally from Oklahoma, which was composed by Rodgers and Hammerstein. So it's very in that kind of standard land, if that's even a land.
Yes.
And it's a perfect kind of standard to really play with as an arranger, because it's actually quite simple, you know, when you go down to it. So in the original thing, there is this verse, when I take you out along with me thing. And what I really love about this, the start of this piece, how Marty Paich and Mel Torme deal with it, is they almost do a brass chorale as a colla voce thing, and it is triadic, you know, this mostly triadic, this start, which sounds really quite hip after everything that has happened before it, you know, in terms of, you know, there's no real extensions or anything. And because of that, you have like a few instruments doubling each other. So it sounds really fat.
Mm.
It sounds really fat, which gives a lovely platform for Mel Torme to just, you know, do his thing on top. And then when we get to Snow White Horses, is the first time you hear kind of the jazz bit of it come out. And not only that, going back, this whole section has like a pedal thing happening over it.
Yes. Feel free to play it on the Out of Tune piano if you wish.
Yeah. Oh, whatever it is, you know, it's kind of it's a really great way to build up that energy of and suspense of where it's going to go, because the tune before is actually the same tempo, more or less. When it gets into it. So it's actually really nice to have that kind of space again.
It's like a buffer in between two things of a similar... Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think it's very classical. That I would call it classical, that opening. And particularly, he even does that da-da-da-dee-da-da-da, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah,
sort of
absolutely.
Almost Mozartian or
yeah.
Brahms or something.
Like, the first thing when I listened to it was like, oh, this is a brass band.
Mm.
Like, but it's not because it's American.
Mm.
But it's... but it sounds like a hymn,
yes.
That start. And then you have that Snow White horses.
And it goes into a hip.
Yeah.
Sort of minory extension, yeah.
Yeah, and then you have the... Which in its sound, in the way he's written it as well, sounds quite musical theatre. It sounds quite...
Well, which it is, of course.
Of course it is, but... In terms of, like, it sounds Hammerstein-like.
Yes.
And then you have the hymn bit of, again, going back to what you talked about the French horn being, like, quite a soloistic instrument. And it goes quite high as well for the French horn.
I think he got, on this one, I think he got Vince DeRose, who was, like, the premier French horn dude.
Yeah.
At the time. And he does write, I mean, he does... Of all the instruments that he picks, he really likes the French horn. And so you hear him use it as a... For example, the introduction to Round Midnight on... that sort of...
Yeah.
That phrase turns up a few times in his on French horn in his arrangements. And
It's really funny because, like, of all... in that era of like Marty Paich, Johnny Mandel, John Williams, they all use the French horn a lot.
Yeah.
You know, one thing that comes to mind is like the Here's to Life, Shirley Horn album with Johnny Mandel, the title track, Here's to Life, or the... you know, which no one can play apart from like
Vince DeRosa.
Exactly.
He was a stellar player. The whole point with the reason we're talking about this in a way is because at some point, hopefully soon, there will be a gig of these charts that, and Giles has very helpfully transcribed a few of these charts for me. So the idea is that if we can go ahead with this, I will get a good classical French horn player.
Yeah.
Because it's more important to have a good tone and be able to play the notes than it is... there's no improvising on French horn in any of these albums. So you don't need a Jim Rattigan type player. Although, of course, he was a RPO player himself. But
yeah, absolutely.
You don't need someone who can wander off the path. You want someone who can play like Vince DeRosa did with that beautiful...
Yeah.
Pure, I mean, he is legendary in so many Hollywood scores as well. He was on.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's carry on. So now we've done the introduction. We're going to go into the main part of the tune, aren't we?
Yes, absolutely. So then after this big kind of finish of da 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 da, da it's then drums, bass, and voice. Like you said, it's a lot of space. Throughout the track, there's a lot of space for, you know, and actually it any other singer would find this really quite vulnerable.
Yes.
Because you got nowhere to hide.
I can't remember. I think it was Charlie Rouse who said soloing over Monk was like stepping off into an empty lift shaft.
You know, it's and even, you know, the bass at that point is just playing two notes a bar. Dum, dum. So it's even less. And, you know, that's a really big risk.
I think what's so good about it is that and it happens a lot in many of the tracks on these albums, is that with someone like Mel Lewis on drums, he's a drummer you could just listen to play time. It's so beautifully played and so tasteful. And the bass players are often people who really know how to do what I call it's a two feel, but it's not a trad 2 feel.
Yeah.
It's a sort of mobile 2 is what I call it.
Yeah.
So you'll have, I think it is Joe Mondragon, if I'm right. Am I? I've got them listed somewhere here. So he'll go dum, 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 gung, gung.
It's kind of a two walking.
It's sort of a walking two, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's why I've always transcribed the bass parts from these charts, because I think they're so important to the feel of it. And I think probably I asked you to, or maybe I did, sometimes I do the bass parts myself.
No, I did the bass part to this one. Yeah. And to be honest with you, when I do arrangements myself, most of the time, if I'm writing for big band, I do put a suggested big bass part in.
Because it works with the voicings, and that's the important part of it, isn't it? You can sometimes, so like some bass players can say, well, you know, I don't need it, I just need the chords. It's like, well, yeah, but you might be playing a third in the bass when I've got a root in the bass all the other way around.
Yeah.
And, I need you to be doing that while they're doing this, or whatever, you know. It's anyway, so carry on. Yes, so we have our
So we have that, and then the horns come in on ba 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 da da thing, and again going back to that use of tuba, it's still on kind of root notes, but it. You know, as an arranger using double bass and tuba, you've got to be incredibly careful because they're in similar frequencies.
Yeah.
And the way they use it within the section is really, really takes the muddiness away. And you know, we're in the era that, you know, 10 years before, you know, even bass trombone might do the root, but a lot of the time it you know, the bass was the bass. You know, and you know, that's I guess it's kind of down to the kind of the era of this, the birth of the cool sketches of Spain, and obviously, you know, Marty Paich kind of thing.
I suppose in a way it's an orchestral approach, if you like.
Yeah.
More of an orchestral approach. I mean, there's two ways of looking at this ensemble. You could say it's a brass quintet, a traditional brass quintet, two trumpets, French horn, trombone, tuba, with three saxophones. So the way I see the birth of the cool band, I see it as three sections. I see it as two reeds, two conical bore instruments, French horn and tuba, and two straight bore instruments, trumpet and trombone. So you could see this as a three-piece straight bore instrument section and a two-piece conical bore section. And he does tend to use the French horn and the tuba together.
Yeah.
Because they have that much more filling sound, don't they?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. You know, but yeah, so we've got that, and as I said, you know, the voicings in general are actually really quite close.
Yeah.
Which I have this thing, especially with piano player arrangers, that they tend to write like a pianist. You know, like, you know, you know, five, no, seven, three, you know, seven, nine, 11, you know, really quite close.
Yeah.
And you know, Marty Paich could, if he wanted to, have done big, fat, kind of spaced arrangements where, you know, the trumpet's going quite high and stuff. But I think on this arrangement, the highest the trumpet ever goes is a concert E flat.
He tends to use, I mean, I think this, there are some, he tends to, he's quite good, I think, at, and this is something I would think what you're saying or implying. Sometimes you should, when you do an arrangement, you should say, this is what I'm going to set out to do, and should try and stick to that. And I think in this arrangement, he is sticking to a kind of classical approach.
Yeah.
And he doesn't, you sometimes get these, in other, even on this album, in other areas, you get these really big gaps between the bottom and the middle and the top. But that's usually, generally speaking, it's usually when he wants to make it sound as big as possible. So he's got like almost a screamer trumpet, then a second trumpet, and then the French horn, or sometimes the trombone above the French horn, sometimes below. But then the tuba is just two octaves below, you know.
Yeah.
And then the filled in with that is a pretty low baritone note with quite a, often dissonant, maybe a ninth away or something, tenor note, and then an alto note a fifth away from that or something. So there are times when he uses those spatial things, but I think you're right, in this arrangement it's quite sort of triadic, moving around kind of approach.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, going into that, the B section, he uses that big four.
Yes.
As well. You know, he uses that all the time, as you said. But he uses that quite effectively in this piece, and throughout, it just feels good for a platform for a singer.
Yes.
You know, and in terms of, you know, going back to this writing like a pianist, you know, the backings are almost written like you would comp.
Yeah, obviously, because there is no piano, I think that he's replacing the piano with the band quite a lot of the time.
Yeah.
But I think also the other thing, I think of it as almost like a string section writing as well. That he's treating when he uses tutti, he's treating everybody like they're all in the same section, even though they're different instruments.
Yeah.
So they're rhythmically in unison quite often, is what I suppose is what I'm saying. So you might have da 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 ba di. Everyone plays, but there's no move. There's no counterpoint.
Yeah.
And it sounds like like you say, one instrument with different bits to it, as opposed to, or like an organ or something, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, and then the bits that come out as solo instruments, you know, you've got the two trumpets cut muted, da 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 da.
Yes.
And then you've got the tuba, solo tuba.
For the end, you mean? Yeah.
No. Further
earlier on.
As well, the tuba does go back and do the solo bit at the end, but in the middle it has the thing, which again in itself is quite non-standard.
Yeah.
You know, you would expect like a, you know, at that time like a sax solo, or like, you know, a trumpet brass thing, or, you know, but then again, you know, stylistically, you know, the bass instruments are now, you know, quite, they're instruments of their own. They have their own kind of place, that
this does feel orchestrated, doesn't it?
Yes.
It doesn't feel like trumpets all play together, trombones all play together, reeds all play together like a standard big band might, maybe a Billy May arrangement. Sort of thing. Great arranger, though, of course, but it's not a bad thing. But it's just that approach is all of the trumpets are one section, all of the trombones are another section, all of the reeds are the third section, then we've got a rhythm section underneath that as a fourth thing. Whereas it feels quite orchestral to me, his writing, particularly on this album. It's very flexible.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you'd... I mean, I think we covered nearly everything on this? Because we're going quite long so far.
There's just one more thing I'd like to add in terms of you know, there is the big band or the deptet is secondary to the voice, more or less all the way through until the key change.
Yeah.
Where you've got you know, this whole kind of shout section. But yeah.
which is a callback to Birth of the Cool, isn't it?
Yeah. But it's over the vocal.
Yeah.
Which, you know, again, you know, he could have written a shout chorus and then vocal comes back in, which most singers would do, and yes, would like that. But in this case with Torme and Paige, Torme is more than happy to sing over this quite big section, which then towards the end of the chart it gets reinstated with the, you know, ba 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 da, and yeah, it's quite, yeah, all in all I think it's an amazing chart. It's just, as you say, really well orchestrated.
It's got a good, I mean, it's one of those charts. Originally I was thinking of talking about Sleeping Bee, and I listened to Sleeping Bee and I listened to Sorrow with a Fringe on Top, and I thought, do you know what, there's nothing in Sleeping Bee that hasn't been covered in Surrey. Yeah. And in fact, there's more things in Surrey than there is in Sleeping Bee.
Yeah.
Sleeping Bee is quite a standard arrangement in many ways. So, yeah, I mean, I do like that end. I mean, my point were about Birth of the Cool was that he's quoting...
Yeah, and it's actually laid back as well. It's super laid back. Which again is you know, the whole Birth of the Cool thing is way back behind the beat, you know. I mean,
that tune, so it's actually a George Wallington tune, Godchild, that Jerry Mulligan arranged for Birth of the Cool. But it's a quote that turns up a lot in these charts. It turns up on the Fred Astaire album. In fact, I think Mal Torme himself even sings that, and then the band echoes it.
All right.
So that's obviously something they particularly wanted to. But there are other parts of the Birth of the Cool, little phrases that come out of Birth of the Cool that are quite clear. Well, look, that's brilliant, and thank you for transcribing it in the first place.
No, thank you. It was a real learning experience. Great.
We'll have a short break, and then we'll go on to talk about Too Darn Hot.
Great.
Which is what I am, so I'm going to turn the air conditioning on. So we're back now with talking about Too Darn Hot, and that is the penultimate track of the whole album. If on vinyls, that will be side B. Of course, if on CD, it's just the penultimate track. And the last track is that one that we talked about earlier, with the only one with piano on this particular album, which is the very wistful, lonely town.
Yeah.
Which is a lovely tune and quite a weird one to end on in many
respects. I was thinking the same thing. You know, in terms of programming, I would have ended on Too Darn Hot and switched them. But it's a very strange one to end on.
I mean, the thing I would say, with that exception, and actually it's my least favourite, I love the tune, but it's my least favourite tune from the album.
Absolutely, yeah.
I would say that overall it's a very well-balanced collection of tunes, very well handled in the right order, with the possible exception of that one.
Yeah.
And maybe a different ballad might have been... A different ballad, like Your Eyes Are the Eyes of a Woman in Love from Guys and Dolls or something. Well, just something that was a bit more actual ballad. Although, of course, at this time, Mal Torme was really trying to not be a ballad singer anymore.
Yeah.
Which is what he'd been known for up until this point. He was... Bethlehem had kind of... He'd moved to Bethlehem Records in order to be given the chance. They said, we're going to book you as a jazz singer, not as a crooner anymore.
Yeah.
So, you know, goodbye Bobby Soxers, hello Strokey Beard Meetings.
Yeah.
Hipsters in polo necks. and all that sort of stuff. Anyway, let's talk about Too Darn Hot. So this is a nice, brisk tune. And one thing I was going to say about Sorry with a Fringe on Top was that the other thing that is quite classical about that approach is that the swing is almost a semi-quaver, isn't it?
So yeah.
There's a couple of parts where it really does go into that semi-quaver swing thing as opposed to the triplet swing thing, which Nick and I have talked about in the past. And we also talked about how Marty Paich, as a pianist, has a quite unusual swing, sometimes almost straight quavers, but he gets the swing into it by emphasising the second of the two every time. And he used that a lot in his arrangements. So you'll hear doo-wah, 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 that sort of thing. Even though there's no plunger mute on it, it almost sounds like it's doing a wah sort of sound.
Yeah.
So in this, we have that brisk introduction with a bit of pedal to get us into the main tune. And it's quite a funny song, isn't it, really? And there's some brilliant Cole Porter was an amazing songwriter in total, because he wrote his own words.
Yeah.
So, like, some of the songwriters worked with lyricists, others wrote their own whole thing. So Irving Berlin was another one who wrote the words and the music.
Yeah.
But Cole Porter, those internal rhymes, a GI for his cutie pie is not, those sorts of little internal rhyme things are brilliant.
Yeah.
But there's always a bit of a tongue-in-cheek. And I think there's humour in the arrangement too, isn't there? I think.
It's
jaunty, I would say. And we were talking in our brief break about words to describe Marty Paich as an arranger. I think he's classy, he's restrained. Hip has come up a lot as a word. He's just got great taste, I think, and that's what's made his charts last and sound fresh now, because they are very solid, but they're not thick. There's air in them. And I was saying about how maybe there's some more adventurous arrangers, like, say, Pete Ruggolo, who did stuff for Stan Kenton, which now kind of, at the time, may have sounded very clever, and now sounds less clever because time has passed and those experiments you have to do. Sometimes experiments don't work, and that's the whole point of doing experiments and finding out what does work. I think by this point in time, Marty Paich really knew his onions, knew what worked.
Yeah.
And there's a few things I really like about this chart. There's the way Mel Torme, particularly on the Kinsey Report section. So basically, the whole point of the song is that when it's hot, people, or men in this case, don't feel particularly sexy. So according to the Kinsey Report, every average man much prefers his lovey-dovey to something when the temperature is low. I've forgotten what that extra word is there. To woo, maybe. And on those sections, there's one... So that already goes up and down, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But there's one point where Mel Torme goes into a new key for every phrase that isn't the normal one.
Yeah.
And then comes back down again without missing any tuning. It's absolutely astonishing how incredibly... I'm not sure if he had perfect pitch, but wouldn't surprise me, because he often starts a song without any piano note being given or whatever, if you hear him live.
Yeah.
He'll just sing the first notes of a song and he's in the right key, So maybe he did have an incredible relative pitch or perfect pitch. And there's a few other things we talked about. There's occasional finger click in this one, which comes up again. Particularly, there's a very driving use of that big four thing. Ba 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 da 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 ga ga ga.
Yeah.
And the one thing we haven't yet talked about is... One thing I found with Marty Paich is one of his Dave Powell Octet tunes may not have been his arrangement, actually, but it was it's a tune on A Pal of a Time, which I think is Bill Holman. It's a Bill Holman tune. I suspect Bill Holman did the arrangement. but Marty Paich was around, played the piano on that album.
Right.
And it, so the idea of you're going along 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, da da do da do da di da do da. So you get back to the beat one quite often, and Marty Paich would do that around a cycle. So go do di do di do di do di do di bombs.
Yeah.
And land back on the one. That happens in this chart quite a bit.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of shout chorusy stuff. There's a lot of we've already talked about in other charts that thing, Mr. Pants, for romance is not ba ba da ba little did it did. So these sort of interjections in the gaps between Mal Torme singing. And it also has that the in the introduction there is something which sort of turns up again on Art Pepper Plus 11, which is the same year, 1960, I think it was recorded the same year, is that sort of bebop.
Yeah.
Those sorts of, almost like bebop, that tune by Dizzy Gillespie, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Those sorts of lines. And that's often trumpet and alto with Art Pepper, who just is, he is one of the great alto players in my book.
Yeah. He's certainly my favourite from that time.
Yeah, I think for me, you know, I always get into trouble by this. I mean, I think Charlie Parker was a genius, but I don't like listening to him much.
I'm exactly the same. I'm exactly the same.
I tend to go for Cannonball Adderley, Art Pepper,
Jackie McLean. Yeah,
Jackie McLean, and actually Paul Desmond I really like, but for different reasons. That's a kind of a whole. It's almost like liking the modern jazz quartet. It's something. It's not. You couldn't only have that. it's a lovely thing, but you wouldn't want to listen to it all the time.
No.
But you know, there's some great West Coasters, weren't there? Bud Shank was very good.
And, yeah.
There's a whole bunch of really great sax players on the West Coast. Well, I'd like to sort of round this whole thing off with just a general. What I've learnt from transcribing Marty Paich, and maybe what you've learnt from transcribing
Absolutely.
Marty Paich. So, well, I'll hand over to you so I don't steal any thunder again. what things do you... What, if you said to someone, before I did transcriptions of any Marty Paich, this is what I didn't know, and now I know it. Are there any things that are clearly in your vocabulary now from him?
I mean, the main one for me is space. You know, he uses space so much in his arrangements, especially with singers. The sometimes, especially if you're recording, the kind of go-to is to just write everything. Write like backings on saxes and then this and then that.
Mm.
Whereas if you just step back from that, you know, it can be really magical. Also, you know, his use again of tuba in an ensemble, tuba and French horn in an ensemble, you know, I wouldn't...
Would that make... Has... Listening to the way he uses it and putting it onto paper, has that made you think maybe for an album I will use those?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because one of my first big bands that I was a small big band. I had an 11 piece band called SW11, and that was basically the Miles Davis Nonette plus two more players, tenor, sax, and doubling clarinet and a flute player, and as I said before the recording went wrong, that's mainly because Gareth Lecrain's such an amazing flute player and plays 26 varieties of flute from piccolo down to contra contra double contra trouser press Montgomery flute.
Yes,
and he's a monster on all of them.
Yeah.
But that idea of using French horn and tuba, it really opened up my ears to. I think one of the things with those two instruments is that if you have, let's say you have an F below, the not off the stave, played by a tuba, and then you have an A played by a French horn two octaves above it, which is right, you know, at the top of the French horn range, you somehow get a load more notes in the middle.
Yeah.
With those particular, that particular, those instruments. So if you then pick out those notes with, say, the three saxes, you get a very full-sounding chord with the tuba and the French horn. And then you've got three instruments left to maybe put extensions on or whatever.
Yeah.
So, yes. And so what do you think... I can't remember where we got to before the recording fell. So let's, if I have to cut it out, that's fine. But let's say, what do you think you've learnt?
Well, as I already said, you know, the amount of space that Marty Paich uses, I've definitely taken that on board for my arrangements. In general, you know, not being afraid to cut back to just bass and drums. You know,
So the kind of old school big band. So if you look at something like a Nijo type approach to big band, it's harder, faster, louder, isn't it?
Denser,
thicker, hit more notes, more extensions, more dissonance. And maybe that's a Stan Kenton thing too, actually. But yes, I think I agree that. I think with the thing I would add to what you're saying about space, which is I think you're talking about the space in terms of time. There's something happening and then there's much less happening and then there's something happening again, so that sort of space. But I think also he does have these counter to what the Surrey on the Fringe on Top arrangement, which is a particular case in point, but he does use a lot of big gaps in the lower end. So one of the things I learnt certainly is that if you've got a baritone sax and a tuba, you've got the bass end covered. You don't really need to write a note below F, below middle C.
No.
And you will have some very nice thick voicings. If you start filling in those, if you start putting the trombone down there or the tenor sax in its low region, it gets muddy. It gets muddy. And also sections using the reeds, there's only three of them, but widely spaced, they can sound very thick.
Yeah.
Using the reeds, and then using the brass ensemble as two separate things that interlock, so that you're not just covering in the standard sort of big band voicing of trumpet at the top, then the second trumpet becomes alto one and blah blah blah.
You
can actually fit in the inside the five brass, you can fit in the saxophones to make it much more, it makes it very silky, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, in terms of chops, sort of arranging chops, are there any, I don't mean instrumentation here, I mean actual sort of arranging approaches or ways of thinking of a standard, whatever. Is there anything that comes to mind?
Well, there's that kind of rhythmic, you know, power four, you know, on the four, really gets you thinking on charts, you know, to explore that, and also the use of just using your extensions wisely. And don't be afraid to do like a triad. Stuff like that, you know.
One thing I find that is interesting with he treats saxophones a bit like pianos, which is you guys can play anything.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if it's dissonant between the you three, because you can play anything and you blow it and you stick your fingers down and that's how it is. Whereas with the brass, it's you have to play in thirds or in tenths or in sixths.
Yeah.
More. So that's an interesting point, I think. I mean, for me, there's certain tropes that he has which I think are really interesting, like that sort of da-do-gat, da-do-git, da-do-gat, da-do-git, those
Absolutely.
Sorts of little kick things that he does. And he'll often do something like, this is me improvising in the style of, if you like, da-do-dat, da-do-dit, da-do-dat, da-do-dit, ba-do-bup.
Yeah,
and then you go into time, those sorts of things for his introductions.
Yeah,
Yeah, and overall, I think, yes, less is more. He's a less is more arranger, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Giles, thank you very much for lending me your time.
Not a problem at all.
And I will let you know when this goes live. I'll probably be able to edit quite a few little chunks out just to make it a bit more manageable. But yeah, we'll hopefully see each other in a gig, at a gig, listening to the charts we've transcribed.
Absolutely.
In the, at least in this year, if not in the near future.
Brilliant.
So it's from me, Simon Whiteside, goodbye.
And it's a goodbye from me, Giles Thornton.